Bill Hansen of Grand Marais just returned from a two-week trip to Kenya, and he has some great stories. I know he was on earlier in the day, but we've asked him to stop by the studio to just share his adventures in Africa. Welcome to the Roadhouse, Bill.
Hi, guys. Thrilled to be here.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed your sidetrack show, but I'm sure it was good.
It was excellent.
You can get the tape here if you really want.
Right. Yeah. It's archived.
I'm sure it is.
Wow. So I just perusing through Annie's notes, and this is going to be an amazing interview. I think I should just let you talk.
Sure. Well,
Give us the backstory. I just got back
from Kenya. I've been back a little more than 2 weeks now. So it seems like months ago now, but great trip. And I went with my son, Adam. And actually, we had a friend of his join us, too, from Texas. But I had gone with Adam to Kenya 7 years ago, 2010. And then the backstory is that Adam, when he was in college in the year 2000, which makes me feel really old.
The turn of the century.
When he was in the college, he did a year, exchange program in Kenya. And the reason he chose Kenya was that the program was half a year of going to school, University of Nairobi, and then half a year of just working out in the country. And he worked for an NGO that was working on their constitution at the time, which they since instituted. So interesting work. But so the basis of our trips going there is I joined him to kind of hang out with him, and he's there not so much as a tourist, but they're visiting people that he knows. And so that's what makes it so culturally interesting. As I kept pointing out during the trip, our kind of the byword of the trip was a culturally genuine experience. And we had plenty of those. And so we had a great time 7 years ago. But going back to 2000, when he was there, he stayed with the host family, of course, and his host mother had hosted other exchange students, and she suggested to him, I think literally the first day he was in country, she said, you know, this was in Nairobi, she said, you know, if you go down to the National Theater, there are musicians that play on the street down there, and they give lessons, and a lot of the exchange students go down there and sign up, especially for drum lessons, you know, being Africa, you should go check that out. And he said, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. So he went down there. It was either the first or second day he was there. And sure enough, there are all these musicians playing. And he noticed a guy playing a harp-like instrument, which he later learned was called the Nyatiti. And it's a tribal instrument from the Luo tribe, which is one of the larger tribes in Kenya. And he was just struck by how expert this, how beautiful the playing was that this gentleman was doing on the street. So he got intrigued with that and hung around him for a while. And he had a friend there, the musician had a friend who spoke English. And so it turned out that this fellow that plays in Nyatiti's name is Joseph Nyamungu, and his last name is Ohingo, something like that. He rarely uses his last name, and he really goes by Nyamungu. And he's of the Luo tribe. And he had fairly recently come to Nairobi, so he wasn't even fluent in Swahili. He just spoke a few words of Swahili, which is sort of the Franca lingua there that people speak. And so he only spoke his tribal language, but the drummer spoke English. So Adam signed up for lessons with Nyamungu. And he said right from the first hour they were together, they had a bond. They just, something about it, they just looked at each other and they're like, we are going to be friends. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the first like 7 or 8 lessons, he had an interpreter there. But because Nyamungu was learning Swahili and Adam wanted to learn Swahili, they kind of learned it together. And it's funny because to this day, they speak exactly the same dialect. They have pretty much the same vocabulary and everything. So they both learned it. So Adam, over the course of the year, not only became fluent in Swahili, but learned to be quite a master at this instrument, the Nyatiti. He actually graduated from apprentice level to journeyman level. And it turns out that Nyamungu is a master musician. I mean, he's like at the level of Heifetz or Leonard Bernstein, or, you know, I mean, he's that good of a musician and is in much of Kenya that respected as a musician. He actually comes from the far western part of the country, way out in the sticks, you know, out in the bush. And he was an orphan. His mother died in childbirth, and he grew up completely uneducated. He never went to a day of school. To this day, he can only write his name, doesn't know the alphabet, but he's brilliant. Adam always says if he'd gone to sixth grade, he would be the president of Kenya right now. And there's some truth in that. And he is really an interesting guy. And but, you know, as a musician, obviously he was not a wealthy person, to put it mildly. And in Kenya, that means his annual income at that time, when I was there in 2007 and when Adam was there in 2000, initially his income was probably around $300 a year, which is, you know, not that untypical there for people.
So, Bill, was Namugo that famous in, at the time, like back in 2000?
Well, he was famous in, among his tribe, I would say, and somewhat
in the
country.
17 years he's...
Yeah, so that's part of the story.
Okay.
So he and Adam, and then it turns out that Nyamungu and I were born on the same day. Same year.
How old is he?
We're 64. He's exactly my age. His passport says that he was born in 1952, which would make him 65, but when I was there this time, he was showing me his passport, and he said, it says 52, but he said, I know I was born in 53. That's just a clerical error that they made at some point, probably bad penmanship.
Right.
Of course, he was born at home, so quite a coincidence.
You guys are like twins.
Well, in their tribal culture there, your age class has much more import than it does in our culture.
I see.
So if you're even close in age, you're sort of grouped together and you have certain responsibilities as you move through life, and those change. And from age, you know, 50 to 60, you're sort of the worker bees of the community, you know, organizing stuff, getting stuff done. And then once you get past 60, you're the elder. And but to be born on the same day creates an immediate bond in their mind. And so he and I bonded as well. So we went back in 2000. So that Adam ended up going out to his village a number of times. And then finally, at the end of his trip, he went and spent a few weeks at Nyamungu's village. And they actually had quite a ceremony for Adam where they inducted him into the village. He has a great picture of him wearing a partial traditional native costume. And he's 6'7". And there are very, very few Kenyans that are that tall. And it really was Nyamungu's costume. They kind of split the costume. And Nyamungu's like 5'7", you know, so 5'6". So it's a pretty hilarious picture. But they dressed traditionally. They presented a concert to the whole village. And then he was formally sort of inducted into the village. And they gave him half an acre of land, which was forested. And to this day, 17 years later, it's become a landmark in the village. And people call it Adam Forest. It's not Adam's Forest. It's Adam Forest. And it's, you know, if you say to anybody in the village, oh, yeah, we're down by Adam Forest, they're like, oh, yeah, I know where that is. Yeah, of course, Adam Forest, everybody knows. So he sort of technically owns that piece of land now there. That's part of the ceremony to, you know, sort of welcome him to the family. And there's a lot of talk there in the country. You know, half the people we met, Nyamungu, would say, this is my brother, this is my father. And they're not, you know, technically his brother and father, but it's just indicating a close relationship like that, like a brother or sister. And so he says that Adam is his son, and they're very close to this day. Super cool guy. So we went back 10 years ago. I'm sorry, 7 years ago, I went and joined Adam there for 3 weeks, and we worked in the village, actually starting a business, a fish pond, that Nyamungu was kind of looking at as a retirement income, not being able to really rely on music for a full-time job. But while we were there, he was in contact with some young British rockers had come over to Africa sort of looking for tribal musicians to play with. And they had stumbled across Nyamungu on the street, just like Adam had. And they were, at that time, arranging for him to come to England and start a band with them. And Adam kind of checked it out. He's a lawyer, so he kind of checked their background, make sure they were on the up and up, and they were. And he talked to them, and they were, you know, very respectful of him. And they were really building the band around Nyamungu. And so we helped him get stuff arranged for that. You know, it's hard when you can't read to get stuff arranged. And actually, when we got back, we got a couple calls at 4 a.m. Adam was visiting me, you know, to get last-minute arrangements, and he ended up going to England. Well, it turns out that these guys are associated with Damon Albarn, who is the leader of the Gorillaz, and in at that time, one of the biggest rock stars in the world. And he actually did sit in and play with the band that year in London. And of course, as soon as he was associated with it, they took off. And since then, Yimungu has been, the last 7 years, has traveled to over 30 countries going to world music festivals with this band, and it's called the Winnie-Sagoma Band. So it's some kind of hip, young British guys. In fact, the keyboard player from Winnie-Sagoma is out on tour with the Gorillaz right now, so they're kind of on hiatus while he does that. They played in St. Paul a month ago, so they're, they're big rock, I mean, they're arena band, you know. Gorillaz, and they also opened quite famously 2 years ago. They opened for Radiohead, and Yimungu actually got to talk to Thom Yorke and got respect from Thom Yorke, and he says proudly, you know, Thom Yorke knows who I am, and he does, because he gets that kind of respect. Yeah. So I have a little snippet here, if you can play it, Dave. This is the Winnie-Sagoma Band, so this is sort of it's sort of a cross between modern British rock and traditional Ngatiti music based around Yimungu. So that really was, that is mostly Yimungu just playing by himself, excuse me, in that instance. And what's going on there is it's an eight-stringed instrument, looks like a harp. And he squats down on the ground and plays the eight strings in that rhythmic, it's really more of a rhythm instrument than a melody instrument. And then he has a big brass ring on his big toe. Sounds absurd, but there it is. And then he has bells on his calf, and you could hear those. And then he whacks the back of the instrument with the brass ring as he's playing, and then you hear the jingling of the bells on his calf. And then the words are improvised, or you know, he has some set songs, but often are improvised. And they're usually double entendre. So they sound, you know, on face value, they're kind of nonsensical, yet they're sort of political. And then they're also kind of dirty at the same time. So it's pretty, there's a lot going on there at the same time. To do that all together is quite a skill, and he does it better than anyone in the world. When we were there in 2007, he said that he was the second best Ngatiti player in Kenya. And since then, that the fella has died. So he claims to be number one, and I haven't heard anybody dispute that. He's really well respected. So we both then and this time we went up to his village and lived with him basically, and he's very, very well respected, and it's interesting to see how his status has changed now that he's made a little bit of money. And he's, before he would just sort of crash with relatives when he was up at the village, and that's what we did. Now he's built his own compound, but it's still very African, it's a farm, you know, subsistence level farm. He has two wives that live with him. One's a sort of an ex-wife, but lives with him, and then a current wife. And then he has three of his own children are living there. He's got two other children live nearby. I guess one lives in Nairobi. And then several orphans. His home village area was where I was ground central for AIDS back in the 90s and early 2000s. And there's kind of a missing generation there. They're from people from age late 30s to the early 60s. There are very few of them around because literally most of them died. The family we stayed with in 2007 lost eight children to AIDS. So it was pretty amazing. So there are a lot of orphans, a lot of young orphans. So he has several orphans that are related to him that live with him. And then he has a very elderly woman that's distantly related to him that he's taken in. There really isn't a nursing home system there. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a deal. And then they farm, and it's no running water, no electricity, you know, but very clean, very well organized. You know, the first day we were there, they killed a goat, and we had goat. And it's really interesting and fun. It's fun to be there with Adam because he speaks Swahili, so we can really communicate with people. So we did almost nothing that was like tourist oriented. And there's kind of a real set way of relating in the village, which is semi-formal. So every day some members of the village would come by. They'd come in, we'd sit, you chat for a little while. Then there's a formal introduction period where you go around the room and you tell who you are, who your parents were, who you're related to, where you're from, what you do, and why you're there. And then it goes to the next person. And we went through, and then you have something to eat, and then you have tea.
And so every day?
A couple times, usually every day. And it takes
the same people?
Or no, different people every day. Yeah. Well, I mean, some were, you know, Nyamungo and his family were there every day, but different folks from the village would come in. And it was people he wanted us to meet and people that wanted to meet him. And some of them were old friends of Adam. Some of them I even knew from the last time I was there. So, but that's the process.
That made you feel
special. Yeah, that's the process. It is. And it's really cool because it really gets a lot of information out fast. And then you share the food. Of course, you eat with your hands. They eat a lot of chicken there. We ate a lot of chicken. And of course, when they say you're going to have chicken, they say, yeah, we're going to have chicken for lunch. And then a few minutes later, you hear, bark, bark. And then you have chicken.
You know
it's just like that, yeah. And but they do have a tradition there. The head and the feet are considered a delicacy. So last time I made a joke. When I was there, they served us chicken, and the feet weren't in there. And I said, oh, where are the feet? And they said, oh, and they went and got them. And I was like, oh, boy, I shouldn't have said anything. And I demurred as, and they know that Americans don't like the head and feet, so they, you know, they don't try to push it on you, but they're very, very, you know, sweet, polite, friendly people. And, but this time I decided to have a genuine cultural experience, and I tried both the head and the feet.
All right.
And they're, you know, they're good. They're fine. Tastes like chicken.
Oh,
very good.
And a very special guest, Bill Hansen, live in Studio A, sharing his experiences from Africa. He and his son Adam have extensive cultural immersion. Sounds like a recent 2-week trip got him sampling the local delicacies. Any other oddities, food, gourmet that you experienced?
You know, when I went there in 2007, I said to Adam, you know, as we were traveling over, I said, you know, I don't really know what Kenyan food is like. I don't think I can't picture, you know, Ethiopian. I've had Ethiopian cuisine. I've had even South African food. And he said, have you ever seen a Kenyan restaurant anywhere? And I was like, no, I never have. And he's like, there's a reason for that. The food there is good, but it's very simple, very country.
Okay.
And their main staple is a product called ugali. And it's made from either from wheat or a cassava. And it looks kind of like a loaf of bread, but it's not baked. It's boiled somehow, I think. So it's just this dense, tasteless, like dough.
Oh.
And very sustaining, you know, and they eat it so they can work in the fields and do all the work they do. But it's not something you would find on a gourmet menu anywhere. And then a lot of beef and a lot of goat and a lot of chicken and a lot of good vegetable dishes and that kind of thing. So
tell us about the fish pond a bit more, speaking of
The fish pond is
aquaculture.
Yeah, we got a fish pond going. The reason they're building fish ponds in Kenya is that the fisheries collapsed in Lake Victoria, and this village we were in is just a few kilometers north of Lake Victoria on one of the major rivers that feeds Lake Victoria. So fishing, natural fishing had collapsed. So they build these aquaculture ponds to provide tilapia, which is native to Lake Victoria, to people there. And it went very well for 2 years. It wasn't a service project or anything. It was straight up business. And there were four partners. Adam was the lawyer. And then there were four, you know, partners that were owners. But the guy who, Nyamungu was kind of planning, I think, to be more involved as he got on toward retirement age, but now with his music career taking off, he's not interested in that anymore, too busy for it. And the partner, one of the partners was a managing partner, so he was like in charge of it day to day, and he unfortunately died after 2 years of AIDS. And so he with his death, it lasted a little longer and then they shut it down. But they do have all the equipment. They could open it up again. They just don't, they haven't been able to find anybody. It's a pretty, like any kind of farming like that, it's pretty all day, every day, you know, 24/7, 365. And they haven't found anybody that's really wants to dedicate themselves to it. But we went and looked at it and it's all good. It's all ready to go. And just, they could start it up again any time. So, So that was fun. Among the many, many things that we did, one evening they said to us, Nyamungu and his couple of friends that kind of hang out with him all the time said, tomorrow we'll go see the house where Obama's father was born. And we said, oh, okay. And it's only like 20 kilometers away. So okay, that sounds good. When we were there in 2007, they asked us if we were going to go visit Obama's grandmother who lived there. And we kind of said no. And they were kind of scandalized. They said, you know, that's kind of impolite if you're this close not to go visit her. And culturally for them, it is. But they kind of assume that we know the Obamas, you know, because we were both from America, so we must know each other. Right. And that's just sort of village thinking, you know. And we were like, no, we don't really know the Obamas, so, you know, we wouldn't really be comfortable. So anyway, they said, that's where we're going to go tomorrow. So we drove over there in the morning, and I had been told with great authority from somebody else that his grandmother no longer lived there. But we got there, and it's a little farm, a very modest little farmhouse where his father was born. It's got a fence around it, but it's not a security fence, just a wire, like an animal fence, and a little gate, you know, so we didn't feel like we should go in, you know, so we're kind of standing there looking at the house, and this guy wanders down and talks to our hosts in Luo for a little while, and he went away for a while, came back, and he said, okay, you can come in, and they opened the gate. So we walked up to the house and kind of looked at it, and when Obama became president, he built his grandmother a little nicer house behind her original house because it was a very simple, you know, dirt floor farmhouse. And so there's like a, you know, three-bedroom house with running water behind it. And we kind of waited around by the old house for a while. The guy went away again for a while, and all of a sudden he showed up and said, she's agreed to see you. Come on in. And we're like, what? and even our hosts, you know, had no idea that was going to happen. They thought she was gone too. Turns out she was still there, and in we went. She was watching TV and watching the election coverage, and we stayed for an hour and a half and visited with Obama's grandmother. It's actually his step-grandmother. His grandmother, his real grandmother, died in the 80s, so it's his grandfather's third wife, actually. And she was pretty open about it. Lovely lady, 95, very sharp for that age. She is planning to move away kind of into assisted living. And she said when he became president, she had a lot of visitors. And people were coming all the time. And I get the feeling now, not too many. That's kind of passed. But she never went to school a day in her life. She's illiterate. And so education is her issue. So she's done a lot to build up schools in that region. And that's her thing. And she's been to the U.S. several times. The family, the Obamas, have been to her there to visit her. And her granddaughter, her biological granddaughter, is the same age as Barack Obama. And they're close. She lives in Nairobi. So when I talked about the girls, you know, Malia and Sasha, she said, oh, I hear about what they're doing through my granddaughter. You know, so they're in touch, but not in close touch. So that was lovely and random.
Yes, and she's this teeny little woman sitting between great big Adam and great big Bill Hansen in this photo on the website.
Surprisingly sharp. The really funny part about that was that Nyamungu, we got there, and she's, you know, she's 95, so she's a little bit repetitive in her talking, a little forgetful, but pretty good, pretty sharp. But so she would kind of give these speeches. Well, 10 minutes in, Nyamungu fell sound asleep. Oh. And so he's sitting there right next to her, sound asleep. And I'm biting the inside of my cheek, trying not to laugh. And luckily, she's blind, pretty blind, so she couldn't really tell. And so pretty soon he woke up and looked embarrassed, you know, and tried to look attentive. And 10 minutes later, he's out again, sound asleep.
Musicians.
Yeah, musicians' hours.
Bill, do experiences like that make the world feel smaller to you?
Yeah, I mean, and just really shows you what's common in humanity, and just like wherever you go, people are, and that's the next part of the story I want to tell, is that we actually planned the trip to be there after the Kenyan presidential elections, because, you know, at times in the past, their elections have become fairly heated, and there's been violence, and So we thought, you know, it's better to skip that. So we planned to be there a couple weeks after the election. Well, as many people probably know from the news, the Supreme Court overturned the election and declared a new election. So we actually were there right in the heart of campaign season. And the opposition party, which is, it's all tribal there. The parties are made up by coalitions of tribes. And the Luo tribe is in the opposition. So the people we were with were for the opposition. And so there were demonstrations every Monday and every Friday. Well, the Friday we were there, we were traveling back to Nairobi, and we had a car, and we're driving back, and we drove into the city of Kisumu, which is the third largest city in Kenya, which is, you know, probably a million people or close to it, big city. And we knew it was Friday with, like, well, maybe we'll see some demonstrators, you know. And we drove in. Well, little did we know that Kisumu degenerated into anarchy that day. There was a big demonstration, and then looters took advantage of that and started burning and looting buildings in the heart of the city. And we ended up driving smack into the looting. I mean, we drove right, there's a big roundabout right in the center of the city, and we drove right into it, and it was barricaded, so we couldn't get out. I mean, barricaded with, like, burning tires and barricades and people rioting, basically. All of a sudden, we're in a riot. And it was kind of scary and kind of funny at the same time. We didn't really feel threatened. And I don't think anybody was feeling any animosity toward us. There was a lot of sort of tension in the air. And of course, the burning tires and stuff. But mostly the crowd was like, holy smokes, look at these tourists just drove into this riot. So they're yelling at us, but kind of good, you know, good naturedly, like, what are you doing here? You know? And so I was driving. So I drove up to the barricade and I just pulled a Yui and went back out on the one-way street. And then that caused a whole another round of, hey, you're driving the wrong way on a one-way street. And I'm like, yeah, I don't care. I don't want to park in this riot. So we drove out of there and, you know, we felt okay about it. It wasn't, we were sad to see people looting, you know, that's never good. But while we were there, they barricaded the rest of the streets, so we couldn't get out. So we drove around for a while. We were going to try to go around the city, and finally we came to a barricade with a crowd that we couldn't get through. So we stopped, and I rolled the window down a crack, and the first guy that came to the window said to me in very good English, said, relax, everything's going to be all right. Nice. And I was like, yeah, we're kind of in a riot here. And he said, 50 cents and we'll take down the barricade and you can go. So we said, which is 50 shillings in Kenyan money. So we said, okay, you know, that seems fair. So rummaged around and Adam could only find a 100 shilling note. So this is classic Adam. He hands him the note and says, I want change.
Yeah.
And the guy just looked at him like he was crazy. And he's like, give me my change. And the guy said, you go now. They took the barricade down and we went. So again, it was sort of a little scary, but really, you know, mostly just humorous and not good for their, not good for them to be having that kind of strife. But we didn't feel like we were ever in danger or, you know, threatened at all. It was just sort of odd and a genuine cultural experience for sure.
There you go.
So that was, I don't want to make that sound like it was a big part of the trip, because most of the trip was just these lovely long evenings of drinking tea and chatting and playing music. And at one point we had a Japanese musician who lives in Nairobi, an American musician who lives in Nairobi. The Japanese woman only spoke Swahili and the tribal language and Japanese. The American spoke Japanese and Swahili and English, of course. And then Yimungu only spoke the tribal language and Swahili. A couple of the other people only spoke the tribal language. And then there was us who only spoke English. So it was this really interesting conversation with Japanese, English, Swahili, and Luo flying around the room at different times. But that's the kind of thing that we just love. And we just had a ball there.
And did you find that music was the universal, that you could all speak through your music? Did you play over
there? Yeah, you know, I didn't play. I was kind of disappointed by that. I wanted to, but it just didn't come up as an opportunity. Nimungu is a top professional, so he's a little funny about just playing for the sake of playing. He pretty much wants to get paid if he plays. And he did play for us. But it was more sort of casual. He'd just sort of pick it up and start playing. And there, he talked a couple times about jamming, but we never really had the opportunity. So he did show us. He showed me his passport, and he's traveled, as I said, to over 30 countries, Nimungu, with this band, Owini Sagoma. So while we were there, we called some of the members of that band, or Adam did, and talked to them about possibly doing a tour in the U.S. this year. And Nimungu is very interested in that, and I think he's going to come even if they can't. He'd like to come with them and actually set up a tour nationwide. If that, they're pretty busy guys, so if that doesn't happen, he'll come on his own. But either way, he'll come to Grand Marais, so everybody can meet him.
Ooh, and we'd love him on the Roadhouse.
That'd be fabulous. It'd be really fun. Yes. Be really fun.
So. Great stuff, Bill. Great stuff. International.
Bill Hansen.
Well, I have to say I owe it all to my son, Adam, who, you know, made those connections. And it was really gratifying for me as a father to see how well-respected he was. I mean, he has many other friends that we visited there, too. And everywhere we went, people are just like, would say to me, in fact, Bill is a word that's really hard to say in the tribal language. They don't have those sounds. So they just call me Baba Adam, which just means Adam's father. And I got all kinds of respect for being his father. And just everywhere we went, people said, you know, Adam is a special guy. You know, we have this special relationship with him. We love him to pieces. We're going to be friends for life. And that's really gratifying as a parent to see that he's bonded with people in that way. Hats off to him, and thanks. I thank him for taking me and including me in these really great, genuine cultural experiences.
Well, and now we got a new nickname for you, Baba Adam.
Yeah, Baba Adam.
Thank you, Bill Hansen, for sharing these experiences on the Roadhouse.
My pleasure.
Awesome. Thank you,
Thanks
Bill
for
Hansen.
Having me.